is a constructed stupa. I don't know who constructed it. I can't remember where it came from. It has various layers of lotus flowers out of which four Buddhas, there's these, five Buddha families, four are on the outside and one's in the middle. And somebody put some energy into creating it. And the energy that gets put into creating Buddha images and stupas is part of what they are. When Sally was making this image of Manjushri Bodhisattva on the lion, it was a wonderful process. Sally's an artist, as you can tell by looking at the image, and she put some serious attention into it. It was kind of, she made it in clay, and then she made a mold around the clay, and then she could make kind of plaster, something like that, several images within that mold. But when she was making the clay original, she would come by, she'd make it a little bit, and then she'd come by and we'd kind of look at it and to kind of consult together and how about a little bit more like this or that. And as I remember, this was some years ago, as I recall, at one point, she brought it by and I thought, that's perfect. She's really got Manjushri. And then she's like, well, maybe I'll do a little more touches. And then she went back and completely mushed it down into clay and started again. I was like, really? It was just as easy to have it. My thought was she really wanted to get the feeling of Manjushri and his serenity and wisdom captured just so. And in the artist's mind, it was, to me it was that looks great, but it's not quite it. So in the end, I think it's just right. But that attention that goes into making a Buddha image to create a kind of feeling around it, that's the artist's mind, right? But then we have this unique thing with Buddha images and stupas is that after they're created, then maybe many beings relate to them not just as art objects, which is already a kind of intimate relationship, but relate to them by making offerings and bowing to them. So it's to me it almost seems all the more so that the artist who makes the images has this deep practice of creating something that that can draw out people's feeling and devotion. So therefore, Dharma art is, not called Dharma art, but it's often it's all connected with devotional practices, is often really moving. With an artist's mind, I love Dharma art. Being over there in India, especially Nepal, the Tibetan art and is just exquisite, and you're surrounded by it everywhere you go. Temple walls are completely covered with these intricate murals of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in bright colors from every square inch. Even the beams are all exquisitely painted, and there's these Tanka paintings being produced, images being produced all around the main stupa of Bodhnath in Kathmandu, and Buddha and golden Buddha statues everywhere for sale, and in temples being bowed to, and almost like no differences. You're just surrounded by it everywhere. Yes.
I just wanted to share something, an experience that I had that taught me a lot, since you're mentioning Sally and her artist mind. I'm a very amateur, I love art and I love making art, but I'm very unskilled. But I have a little, you know, journal that I draw little pictures in and everything. And it's interesting because I showed it to Sally one time, my journal, and I was all, oh, that one sucks, that one's really bad, you know. And I have this attitude of what I thought about my pictures and which ones I thought, like, were good and not. And one that I had drawn and I had sketched it really fast at Point Lobos of ocean and a little bit of rocks. And I remember while I was doing it, I felt very agitated. And while I was drawing, I was thinking, I don't know why I do this. I don't know what I'm doing. This really is a stupid drawing. But I did it. And when Sally saw that, she said, that is alive. That is alive. And I find that by showing her my pictures that I have judgments about, she'll say, that one's alive, that one's alive. And then I'll go back and look at those ones. And it's like a practice, you know. Well, wow, it is kind of alive. Look at the difference between that one and this one that I thought was so good because I executed it correctly. With this one, that was just an expression. And it was agitation and judgment. But what showed up on the paper was alive. And it's still a big koan for me, but I think it's a really good practice I recommend all of us.
Well, and part of part of your practice was actually to show it to somebody else other than the artist,
right?
And they can see the aliveness. So part of this, you know, just in art in general, it's kind of a relational thing.
Yes.
Not always. I mean, sometimes it's just a private thing. Nobody ever sees your art. But what we're talking about in Dogen's essay, he's particularly mentioning Buddha images and stupas, which are, you know, almost always going to be related to by viewers, and more than viewers, kind of like relating to it in some way. So I think because Dogen's bringing up this you know, unconstructed merit and virtue, and particularly making Buddha images and stupas, he listed some other things, but then he's just going to single out these two, and he keeps talking about them. So it's, you know, I've just been considering, what is this thing of Buddha images and stupas? Yes.
It took some time, but I have considerable respect for some other traditions, including the Ten Commandments. One of them I never quite understood.
Yeah.
I must say, I don't quite understand it.
Graven images.
And idols.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have great appreciation for Buddhist art. I have great appreciation for the effect and for the warmness that it can cultivate and help facilitate. Certainly in the classical literature in the West, Marco Polo in the West, Buddhists are referred to as idolaters. It's a common word. My own conversion to Buddhism, I don't really see idol, whatever an idol is. I'm not quite sure what one is, except in primitive cultures and in some of the commentaries, it's a matter of endowing the object with power itself, rather than as a representative.
Mm-hmm.
So, in view of your lectures and your expositions, how do you view the word idol? First of all, what does it mean in your view? And how does it relate to Buddhist objects and images and figures? Since the Buddha mind
certainly
is not some object.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. I've been contemplating this, especially.
What's the commandment? I don't know.
What is the
commandment? I don't remember.
False idols or devotional objects. worship false idols, something about idols, and not worshiping idols. Don't worship them.
And I don't know, you know, actually, it'd be interesting to look up the word idol and graven image, because I actually don't know literally what those terms mean. But my understanding, I mean, I think it's a very alive question, because, like, I think you said something that's pointing towards what this is about, is imbuing a physical object with power that, and then worshiping the physical object rather than a representation. I thought, yeah, this is the crux, I think, in here. And I think we really dance with this issue in the Buddha Dharma. because, I mean, we can just, I think a lot of people feel most comfortable relating to like a Buddha image as just an object that represents both the founder, Shakyamuni Buddha, or as Manjushri, who maybe was not actually ever a living person. He's the archetype of perfect wisdom. And Guanyin is the archetype of perfect compassion. So to relate to those archetypes, we create images to represent them. And I think that's, in a way, the easiest way to deal with them. It's most rational. But I would say that all Buddhist traditions go a little bit beyond this. And in America, we don't play out this part so much, but we're starting to. We've done some ceremonies here that around these images that go a little beyond this, which is like, for example, eye-opening ceremonies. It's kind of like putting life into a physical image. So I found one maybe in the first thing of the representational, one teacher said something like, Buddha images and stupas have no physical power as objects, but they have mental power. Or did they have mental power? And I think what he meant is they have the power to remind us of Buddha qualities and inspire us. They have an effect on our mind, but there's no power in the object. And I think maybe this is always the case, but then we can just, again, sort of dance with this fine line about idols. For example, I think the Tibetan tradition dances further across the line than the Zen tradition. So when Kathmandu, Shoho gave me a Buddha image, or an image of Padmasambhava, a Buddha. He's a Buddha, basically. Very beautiful image, because he knows I have a relationship with Padmasambhava. And she's like, I think she has this feeling like, I want to actually like encourage your relationship. She feels like that relationship helps me. So I want to give you this. I wouldn't have probably bought it. And then, as the custom in that tradition is, so let's do the whole custom, is you go to somebody, like in a monastery, and they these statues are metal, they're hollow metal, and you have to fill it, because if they're empty, they say, then it's just, you shouldn't even put it on the altar. They sometimes say, if it's empty, it's just a piece of metal. You have to enliven it in several kind of steps. And so we just, I think it's interesting event that we found. Actually, just we're thinking, oh, we gotta go to one of the monasteries and ask one of the monks to do this kind of empowerment for the Buddha image. But we actually discovered we were like at a restaurant or something, and next to it is this little shop, and like, what is going on in this shop, this little stall where they have these big like compost buckets kind of things that like we have out there, but clear, and they were filled with they look like thread spools, all different colored threads, and the whole shop was, all the walls were lined with these. We're like, it must be a sewing store. At one point we're like curious, like, let's go in. There's a monk, you know, in robes, like running the shop. We're like, well, it's probably not just a sewing store, but what's going on in here? And it turned out he's the guy who fills the Buddha images. That's his full-time job. And these buckets, these little spools, different colored spools, are rolls of mantras, written mantras, and other prayers and sutras and things like that. Tiny little, rolled very tight, and then wrapped in the cloth color of the seed syllable for that particular Buddha or Bodhisattva or deity, of which there's, you know, in Tibetan, there were probably 50 buckets because they have 50 or more different, you know, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, this whole pantheon. And like, oh, okay, we have an image to fill, so we brought it in. Usually I think people just drop them off, but like, I'm like, can I watch you do it? Because I want to learn how to do this. And it was so beautiful to watch this. It's like this guy's job, right? But it's a ceremony that he does. He takes an image, lights up incense, cleans out the inside, purifies it over incense, putting like chip incense into it, and then pouring the chip incense onto the charcoal. So it's kind of like connecting it with the incense while continuously chanting different prayers, and then starts filling it with relics, like amrita, medicine pills made from all kinds of blessed substances that are all over the place in Tibetan Buddhism, and put them into the head, and then there's a wooden pole inside with the different colored threads for the different chakras, you know, of any being has these chakras. You have to put the chakras into the image. And so he's got boxes of different lengths of sticks for all different sized statues. And so that's the center pole. Also stupas have this center pole. And then you start putting in the mantras that go with each chakra at that place. And so there's certain small rolls that fit inside the head. Smaller statues may be hard to do this. And then not only the mantras and prayers that go with this particular being, but then there's room in it for others. So he's like, how about you want some Shakyamuni Buddha? Want some Manjushri? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, how about some Avalokiteshvara? So it's going into all these different bins. And Green Tara? Sure. How about some Dharma protectors? So yeah, and to the end where he's like hammering them in to get them really tight. I mean, maybe 100 of these little mantra rolls hammered in, and there's a little bit of space left, and then it's like you cover it with chip incense, and it's kind of like an offering, so it's completely packed, and then you seal the bottom on.
This is surely very inspiring.
To some people.
Well, it could be to anyone.
Mm. I mean, if you have some faith.
Be inspiring with or without faith.
His devotion was inspiring, right?
Rationality, there are many things that are maybe not accessible to rationality, at least at present.
Mm-hmm.
But even without knowledge, there's some conflict between science and reason. He says, well, you can respect about things. He says, we'll have to change.
Mm-hmm. If we prove that something's not valuable or doesn't work, yeah.
So I would like to ask, what is your understanding of this subject and how far over the line it goes?
Yeah.
In the Sotho Zenji.
Yeah, yeah. So to continue, I think that that kind of ritual, you could say, that's the question now here with that kind of thing. Is this really like, are these like mantras like power charging this like metal thing to make it into a Buddha? Or is it actually the enactment? Is it the devotion and energy? Just like the energy that Sally puts into changing the face a little bit. That's human intention and energy. Is that actually what it is? And it's, and there's no magic actually involved. But because, especially because I watched this monk do this, I felt like now I have a different feeling with this image. When I see the image, I think of him and this relationship and his relationship to that image, and all of that is in there. And then just to continue a little bit with the Soto Zen question is because my teacher had, we did an image filling thing at Tassajara, but maybe he got it from the Tibetans. And here I asked if Sally could leave a hollow hole in the bottom of this Manjushri, so we did fill it with mantras and sutras, and same with all these Avalokiteshvara is also the her chapter of the Lotus Sutra and her mantra. And so, but that's my, there's an energetic relationship. And then we have, in Soto Zen, the main ceremony around this is eye opening. So the Tibetans do this too. After you feel it, that's almost good enough. But if you want to go a little further, you can, first you can bring it to your teacher and they bless it, which I did with my Tibetan teacher. He makes a strong connection. So then he's in there. I see his, because he really related to this very quick ceremony, but, and then the eye opening, and we, you know, open the eyes with a brush. And part of that ceremony too is, it's all about intention, I feel like. And there's a part in this, our eye opening, where we take the brush and you point it at the eye, and both the three eyes, the two eyes and the third wisdom eye, and you aim the back of the brush towards your own three eyes at each of the dots while you're chanting and so on. Some of you were here for these ceremonies. And you say silently, one drop of ink makes a dragon in both places. And you try to be looking straight down the brush lined up with your eye. And so there's some feeling there of like I as this person am connecting with this image, and it's very like, there's some, you have to, it's a concentration thing, right? To be like putting a lot of energy into this, that's what ceremonies do. So I think that my feeling is I feel like it's all about intention. It's like I'm putting mind energy into these things makes them alive. So whether it's a magical thing or not, I don't know. But it's like our... We could say intention meeting, like Kano Doko, right? Like a Buddha and a sentient being meet, and in this so-called mystical communion, bodhicitta is born. Is it really mystical, or is it just interdependent relationship with strong intention creates a world of energy and merit, which is the result of virtuous intentions? Well, Nanette also.
We're going to need to go really soon, and Sally's been waiting.
Okay, well, if you have to go soon, should we let them ask first? Please.
Can I tell someone more our comment?
Sure.
Okay. I was thinking about the merit of making images.
Yeah.
Of Buddhist images. And, you know, part of my practice, you know, involves that, but it's not contingent on that. I think that fostering the Bodhi mind is the most important thing. And when you create art with Bodhi mind, instead of you, like you said, Shoho gave you this thing, and it gave you the idea to, I don't know, deepen this or whatever. Instead of that, when the artist puts the Bodhi mind in it, you're having the direct experience of it instead of the idea of it. And in Nepal, with all those images, which I've also seen, it's really a lot of, I'm making this image, I'm making this image. And it's not quite that Bodhi mind. It's the love of wanting to make Buddhist imagery, but it's not the same thing. And I think
I don't know if it's hard to say like what those people's intention was, right? For you, maybe you don't feel it as much when you look at them.
I can say that what Kathy was talking about, the drawing, which I remember really well. In the drawing, besides it being alive, she was putting time in it.
Yeah.
So you look at it,
time and energy.
Roaring river. I really time was there. And when you look at these images in Nepal, the time's not there. It's very static. And so by...
You mean because they're so refined, maybe? You don't... Like Japanese calligraphy, you see the movement of the stroke.
No, but it's all technique. It's the mind. It's the mind. So you could have a brush stroke in calligraphy that moves, and yet it doesn't have time in it.
What do you mean by time?
It's kind of a complicated question, but it's not static. It arises, it's new as you go through it, and it doesn't die at the end. It doesn't begin. It's new, and it's time. I mean, you have to sort of...
Is it like the dynamic energy that created it in the moment is what you see in the image? Something like that? Like you can see in the image the dynamic energy at the moment of its creation, you can see in it.
Yeah.
That's why I mentioned calligraphy,
it's
because...
It's human, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, time and human.
Time and what?
Being human.
Okay. So, Anika, you can stay and finish whatever, but come over. You can't, but I need to go, sorry.
So, when you say, oh, I don't understand the... you know, the Nepalese art, it's like I'm standing right in front of it and I'm experiencing it. I fully understand because it's right in front of me. You know, the same, I don't know, it's, without projecting anything, you just listen to it and it comes to you and it tells you what it is. So the reason why I bring this up is the merit connected to doing Buddhist imagery, or the merit connected to practice within the art form itself.
Mm-hmm. There could be any kind of image.
That the person takes away much, much more than just the idea of Avalokiteshvara, makes me think of this. The actual teaching should be within the object, so you don't even need some sort of mantra that's put in there to give it power. It already has the power. The power's there.
Yeah, you could say, to say it's just a lifeless thing until it's empowered like that is maybe a skillful means kind of teaching for some people. Just to make the point of like, let's make the mantra filling into an art. I think maybe that would be the one way to see it is like, instead of it's not art until you do this ritual, what can we see the ritual as a further art form to, celebrate. And I agree that like, if it's about the idea of like, oh, this makes me think of this teaching of Avalokiteshvara, I mean, that's not it. I mean, it has to be the first moment actually of seeing an image.
You've seen probably Buddha sitting there and some are just like, there's a lot of this.
Yeah.
Some.
Yeah.
But why is it that it keeps going in me?
Exactly.
Why does it do that?
Yeah.
That's the teaching.
Yeah.
It's right there in the art.
Some leap out. And that I think is, it's the skill of the artist, but also the heart of the artist.
The heart of the artist.
Yeah.
Soul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Accept and believe. Same is true of the rocks in Yosemite Valley.
That no human created.
A human can create such things as someone describes. But my question specifically is, so far as you understand, are the Buddhist images that you're speaking about, stupas, the parts of the practice, And the kind of image that Stephen Batsavi has just described is a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Are they idols in the sense of the Western traditions?
Well, how do you define it?
I don't go further than that. I'm not a scholar of either Judaism or Islam
and neither am I.
But there is that prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
Very strong one.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the greater than images, it's fairly strong, but that's a bit of a problem for Western art, of course.
Yeah.
And that has various ways of sidestepping. Something else, and I wonder your understanding if these images are in the meaning of the Western tradition's idols.
I think it would be nice to ask a Christian scholar, but my guess.
A Christian scholar might not know.
Yeah, then why not?
Because they don't have experience with the Buddhist practice.
Yeah, but my guess about maybe why that's a strong admonition in Judaism, Christianity, maybe because for a kind of dharmic point is that we don't want to limit the ultimate. Into form. We don't want to confuse the ultimate with emptiness with form in some limited way, right?
I think that's to the point, of course, and an important part of it. The question I have, and you're clear or you're straightforward about what I heard you say was, in the sense of, in the understanding of broadly speaking,
mm-hmm.
not the orthodox, not the tight, jihadist, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about that, even if it's doctrinarily correct.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in the broadly speaking, like the Western traditions, Christianity, or especially Judaism, would regard as an idol. If they knew fully how it was being treated in Buddhism.
If they knew that we were relating to it as this kind of energetic relationship to connect with the divine, just like actually there's images of Mary and Jesus all over churches, I think for the same, maybe same function, I think they would understand that.
Protestants, I don't think like that.
Less images, huh? Uh-huh. Yeah. This would be an interesting topic for, we're going to have a Buddhist-Christian dialogue in a couple weeks. Maybe it's too hot a topic, but we might. But it's like if you're asking, what would the Christian understanding of this be? How can I say, right? I mean,
if they understood your approach to that,
mm-hmm.
they considered that you were practicing idolatry, assuming that they had some experience and it
whoever they are, I think we have to ask them what they think. But if I was one of them, and I'd consider myself a student of Jesus Christ and the Old and New Testament, I appreciate a lot of those teachings I say from my understanding of that, I like to see how the all-inclusiveness of all these traditions don't have to be contradictory, at least in these kind of ways. But would an orthodox Buddhist say that this is idol worship? That might be a more interesting question. And because one thing the Buddha said is when you... This, I think, a little bit somewhat related here. When you have the first direct insight entering the path, one happens when one drops away belief in an independent self, doubt about Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and the belief that certain, you know, specific precepts, practices, and rituals in and of themselves are the cause of liberation. So you have to let that go. So I think that's another kind of interesting thing from the earlier Buddhism, is Buddha said that's part of the insight, is you realize that doing certain practices, he was talking to this in this Indian culture where people, the Brahmanism is a little bit like, you just do these practices, if you do the ritual exactly right, then that is the way to liberation. And Buddha's saying, no, it's all about understanding and wisdom of emptiness. And yet, there's all these rituals in Buddhist tradition. So I think just within this one tradition of Buddha Dharma, it's quite interesting to look at how are we projecting some kind of essence into things that isn't there? How, if it's empty, is it, what are we doing in these rituals? Nanette had a question.
I just wanted to bring up the, we were talking about intention,
yeah,
and magic, and
yeah,
I just wanted to bring up the water, I could call them experiments, or
crystal water, yeah.
I mean, I think, yeah, that's so helpful and so clear as a visual.
Y'all know about this?
Yeah. Do you
want
to explain it?
I mean, basically, it's like under a microscope, the crystalline structure of water molecules, I think like this, right?
Completely changes depending on the energy direct that's been
directed. Yeah, so like anger or love, they can look at this under a microscope, watch the image change when you direct different emotions at the water. And the same with like Secret Life of Plants, there's these kinds of experiments. So, and some people argue, amongst the American Zen teachers, a couple weeks ago there was there's these online conversations and get into these hot debates, and one of them was about the effects of prayer, right? So there's been some scientific studies of like, kind of in certain contexts of like when you think about like a well-being ceremony for somebody, that it actually does have an effect on them. And here's the data. And so there was an argument among these teachers of some saying, look, we all know that prayer has effects, or basically intention has effects. And then other teachers saying, because all the stuff's on the internet, right? Pulling out these other articles and say, these scientific studies are like hogwash, you know, like look how they did it, it's ridiculous, it doesn't prove anything. And so there's a debate in this kind of mystical realm. Yeah.
I think this is more like a debate about evolution, and Buddhism will be better than not to engage.
Yes.
So I had this sweet little interaction with Shihaku Okamura on this subject. Because I can't remember my question exactly, but there was some nuance of difference between how the Jiko was supposed to direct her bow after handing off her incense, different between Green Gulch and City Center.
Okay.
So I asked him, and he, you know, his smile. Mm. He said, you know, Buddha is not on the altar.
Yeah. What is on the altar? Yes.
Apparently, was it the Buddha that basically said that no image be made of him, that they could only do footprints for a long time?
I don't know if the Buddha actually said that when he was alive, but it looks like the centuries just after Buddha's life, that was the custom amongst his followers. Let's not depict him for probably the same reasons. So they would make footprints,
yes,
to represent, or an empty chair,
yeah,
like the Buddha's chair.
And the same is true with the prophet.
Uh-huh. So it may be about...
I don't know if he actually said so, but there's no images of Muhammad.
And then, yeah, and then maybe they never came in, but then later in Buddhist tradition, we can't resist the basically the human form.
Yeah.
Because this is what we relate to, is the human form.
Yeah.
So let's make the most serene, settled, loving human form.
Yeah.
And that, it reminds us of the Buddha's qualities.
And I think the same thing is true of Christianity. I'm sure that Christ
mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, it kind of makes me wonder, so when the Buddha was alive, what is written in the sutras as far as what was on their altar?
Or do they have one?
Well, I don't know. I mean, is it Hindu tradition to offer nights,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I think there's no record that I can think of, like in Vinaya, where especially where they talk about lots of ritual practices, where they actually made images to make offerings to. I think it was Shakyamuni Buddha was alive and people made offerings to him.
Yeah, so he'd be sitting there and they'd offer.
And when I think so. And then if he was out of town, that's the question. Did they bow in his direction? We don't know. I don't think. But
they were wandering too.
Yeah.
They didn't have necessarily, set places.
But if we say the Mahayana Sutras are the Buddha, and all of, which we are allowed to say, we have the Lotus Sutra that's very important to Dogen, and supposedly taught by the Buddha. And I find it quite interesting. I just came across this because, in some reference to what we're studying, it says in the Lotus Sutra, I don't remember the exact quote, but something like the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha says, if people make a painted image of the Buddha and make offerings of incense, flowers, and light to it, this is realizing Buddhahood. Or either this is realizing Buddhahood, or this will without a doubt directly lead to their Buddhahood. And I thought, wow! I thought I had to smile because I thought, the Buddha is saying make painted images of the Buddha, you know. Historically speaking, this Lotus Sutra came, after the Buddha's time. But I thought, how wonderful that can be in a Buddha sutra, that is a very important sutra. It says Soto Zen. And Dogen quotes that. That's where I found it. Dogen has a chapter called Kuyo, Shobogenzo Fasuko, Kuyo Shobutsu, making offerings to all Buddhas. And he quotes that line. And he says, this is Dogen saying, you become a Buddha by the merit of making offerings to Buddhas. How can a sentient being who's not made offerings to even one Buddha become a Buddha? There's no becoming Buddha without cause. Which, we probably find contradictions to that elsewhere. And then Dogen quote in that chapter, he has this long sutra quote that's like 5 pages long, and he's talking about some obscure sutra where the Buddha is saying, in a past life, I met countless Buddhas and made offerings of food, clothing, bedding, and medicine to them. In search of complete awakening, but they did not predict my Buddhahood, those Buddhas, because I did these offerings with a grasping mind, or with some mind of seeking my own Buddhahood. And the sutra goes through, in this one past life I made offerings to all these Buddhas, but I was doing it with seeking mind, so it didn't work. But then in another life, I made offerings to all these other Buddhas. And it goes on for pages and pages of all these times that in the past life, the Bodhisattva made these offerings, but he always did so with a grasping mind. And then finally, he just made the offerings without seeking anything. And that's when the Buddha said, oh, through this offering, you will become a Buddha named Shakyamuni. And then I thought this was... this maybe relates to it, to the images on the altars. Dogen says, what benefit can Buddhas receive from offerings of incense and flowers? Like, because, it's one thing if they're like living Buddha and you give it to them, but I think he's maybe referring to like the Buddha on the altar or whatever that is there. What benefit can they receive from these offerings of incense and flowers? However, Buddhas receive them with great compassion only in order to help increase the merit of sentient beings. That's a nice teaching, I thought. Buddhas receive our offerings with great compassion, even though they're not hungry. They receive our food just to help increase the merit of sentient beings. And now we have one understanding of the merit is just the feeling of well-being from having done some virtuous activity. And so often we talk about generating merit. Traditionally, it's all about making these offerings to images, which creates merit. And there's a whole, you can think about it in a really magical way, but maybe now we can see how if you do that with some sincerity, if you really offer, like, may all Buddhas, whoever they are, whatever Buddha even is, may they receive my gratitude through this offering. And the result of that is the merit of feeling good. I mean, I notice sometimes if I'm not really, that's why I was mentioning yesterday, if we do these things just doing the motion, like mindfulness of body or something, I think we miss that good feeling, right? But if there's some like, I just want to give myself and all beings to all Buddhas, and I'm, you know, it's kind of symbolic, but it's also a physical activity. And, you know, thank you. May our connection be alive. And then I feel joyful. Just like now when I see this Padmasambhava image with all these mantras in it and the blessings of my teacher in it. And then I did the eye-opening ceremony for it also, just to add three layers of ritual empowerment to this image. I like, whoa! I mean, it's a really beautiful image to begin with. But now it's really, really like alive for me. And in Tibetan Buddhism too, they say when you have your own teacher, you bow to the image of the Buddha, and you like, and if you're visualizing, you visualize the traditional image of the Buddha, but you're actually, your feeling of the heart and mind of the Buddha is your own teacher's. So you're really bowing to your teachers, but through the image. That's the practice of guru yoga. So that's another relationship. You're relating a living being and a living connection with a person to an image. And because the image maybe looks more like upright and beautiful than your withered old teacher. Yes, exactly. It brings together form and emptiness, which I think is what Dogen's talking about here when he's saying this making Buddha images and making offerings to them is unconstructed merit and virtue.
Yes.
It's a form and it's emptiness.
Yeah.
And like in the Sandhya Mochana Sutra, I just mentioned this while on the topic briefly. The Buddha is like, comes across this group of yogis arguing about, is there a difference or not between ultimate truth and practices? I think that's what Dogen's getting at here too. Some say there is a difference and some say not. And then it gets into all these arguments. If ultimate truth were different from practices, there would be these problems. If ultimate truth were the same as practices, there'd be these problems. So actually, it's not right to say either that ultimate truth and practices are no different, or that they're completely different. Such as the whiteness of a conch shell can hardly be defined as either the same as the shell or different than the shell. I think this is a nice metaphor to contemplate. To contemplate the two truths and form and emptiness is like the whiteness of a shell and the shell. You don't say the whiteness of the shell is the shell, but it's not, it's, you can't separate it at all from the shell. Is whiteness a quality of the shell? Maybe, but then I think that's too limited. It's more like they're two different ways of looking at the same thing. Did somebody else have it? Hannah.
In the mornings, you apparently offer incense to the altar at the entrance.
This Dharma protector?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Could you?
Same thing, making a relationship with through intention with different kinds of energy. One way to say it is like, because, you know, there's Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Dharma protectors, and they all have like slightly different functions and energies. And so you could say, you know, one Buddha includes all Bodhisattvas and Dharma protectors too, but then because my mind is kind of elaborate, I like to elaborate the practices. And just to make a point, like, so, relate, you know, I think of when I'm relating to Ida Somten as the Dharma protector, I'm actually, like, thinking about the protection of this temple and this Sangha and the protection of the Dharma in this place and kind of, like, invoking the energy of that Dharma protector to remove hindrances and obstructions and disasters. So I chant the disaster removing Dharani, the Shosai Myo Kichijo Dharani, for removing hindrance, and the mantra of Ida Somten, and kind of ask him to remove the hindrances of dualistic thought of everyone who passes by, including me. Ida Somten. Ida Ten, or Ida Somten.
Ida.
He's the Ida Ten. He's the, he's on the, if you didn't get one of those little things, yeah.
I never realized that.
You know, it's part of the whole, like, creative Dharma story. I love this stuff. Some people, this is why, you know, I think if I was just like in, you know, kind of maybe Vipassana movement where they kind of like take out all the ritual things, I'd feel very sad and dry. And it, you know, it didn't come at first, right? First coming to Dharma practice, I thought all that stuff was ridiculous. And it's just, over the years, I warmed up to it. I love it. It's a relationship. It's mind playing with mind.
There's a couple of things in it. One of the funny things that came up with us in Dokusan, which is coming up now even more, is how confusing and how confused I am about this whole thing, because I love all the imagery, like totem poles or things that represent, and I believe really carry spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there are spirit animals, I think, or ally, all that, and yet I resist bowing to Buddha right now. That, you know, as we were saying, maybe as we talk about it, but I could see more where someone in the Western tradition, not me because I wasn't raised in a religious tradition, where they could relate more to Christ because of that really being out of our culture. I mean, it just occurs to me that way. And for one reason, because I really surprised myself once, because I've never been in a church really other than to perform, or a synagogue. But I remember once in a dream I was in some kind of real trouble, and I prayed to Christ. And when I woke up and remembered, and also I had some enlightening experience as a result of it, and I thought, I prayed to Christ? I mean, you know, I have no idea who, I don't even know.
In a dream.
But that to say, thought, oh, well, I know why, because that's a cultural embedment. For me, you know, that's, it wasn't Buddha or somebody, I don't know, you know, so maybe I have to become more familiar with this, open because I love the idea of spirit, and I believe that spirit, you know, of all beings exists. I like to think that way. I like to choose to think that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so anyway, that's just this one funny thing.
Yeah,
and I love all of the imagery. And the reason why, I mean, I have Kuan Yin in my house because if you look at something that has value to you, that has a meaning, Kuan Yin has a meaning of compassion. So if you look at something that reminds you to think of it, that's practice.
Yeah.
Oh, that I look at that, I think of compassion, now I'm reminded to practice compassion.
Yeah.
Or just having the thought of it, having something to remind me of.
I think that's the most practical way that I think anybody can understand Buddha images. And people who aren't even practicing Buddhist, whatever that is, maybe have a Buddha image in their house, especially in California or in their lawn. And because people like those images, have some feeling, they invoke some serenity. And I think that's the power of the constructed image. People not even, without even thinking about, I like one of those there. It reminds me of something that's actually my own Buddha nature,
yeah,
even though
well, and that's what you know, and that I want, and that's meaningful and enriching to me, you know. But I wanted to make one other point, and one that I really want to talk to Sally more about, because this visual aspect of art, as opposed to the oral and, you know, musical aspect. Obviously, they must be the same.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and yet I don't see it. You know, I'm not a visual artist, and I can't paint, and I do hear people talking about playing what they see, not what they hear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is always kind of really interesting to me, but what she was, at least I heard, sort of saying, having to do with this question, is what's the difference between practice and realization? Or if there was some kind of question like that. Mm. Are they the same or are they different? Well, in the arts, to me, I think, I believe strongly that they're the same. But that's in the arts. I don't know if that you can translate that into some other, you know, cosmology or something.
I think you can.
I think you can. There, in other words, if you're in the theater, if you don't understand that rehearsal is the same thing as performance, or in any art, but especially with a performance, if you don't understand that your practice of it better have the same life that if it doesn't have any. Where are you going to, how's it going to magically appear?
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, and it's been, you know, a discussion that's been ongoing with me and other players, and but that how your practice better be like your performance. Don't think of it any different way, you know. Otherwise, it's got the deadness of lifelessness or what.
Well, of course, in Zen we say, you know, practice is not a rehearsal for performance, right?
No.
Practice is the performance. So, And your point about culture, I think, is an interesting one that we'll keep exploring, because Buddha Dharma is still very, very new in this culture. 50 years now, maybe seems like a while, but the tiny, tiny infant. So what will, you know, how will this look? And I think it's true that I sometimes too think of, in the intense moments, I think of like God, and I think, I don't know if it's our culture so much as our upbringing.
Well, yeah.
It's like, because it's in our culture. And I'm like, what does that mean? Yeah. But so I think the more, you know, to say that it's like, I think a lot of people maybe do get turned off by like this very formalized kind of Zen thing because it's such like an other culture. And I just think for myself, maybe because of spending a lot of time in Asia too, but I think it's more just like the years of just doing these forms, it doesn't seem the slightest bit foreign to me. But I could imagine somebody coming into it think, this guy is on like on a wild trip. Yeah. Look at all the stuff he's wearing. And yeah, and they chant. I think chanting in Japanese is a little funny because that's, I think, where it gets furthest into like explicitly another language. But in some of the forms too, but I think so, most of them are like universal expressions. So it's nice, I think, when we look at Buddhism, Buddha Dharma coming to a new country is, how did it change? We look at India, China, and Japan,
yeah.
and throw in other countries too, like Tibet. Like, how did it evolve? And then you see there's certain things, like Japan and India are like the most different cultures that I can imagine. In many ways, and yet there's these certain elements that the Japanese took on from India, like this Buddha's robe, like this, you know, this pattern of sewing the robe has not changed from India. But at first in Japan, this was probably like seen as some weird thing, just like it might be in America now. But I think it's almost like to say that there's just like world culture includes all these things, and so. I don't even know if I don't think so much of like my own culture, especially America, because we're a new country too. We don't have like roots of American culture. I mean, we have European culture is the closest thing, but it's a melting pot already. So it seems to be very natural that these things come in, but they already have a change and they'll keep changing. And, but to not be limited, like, this is not my cultural form. Well, what is that? You know, what is my culture? Does it have to be limited to some thing? Yeah. Right. Like, maybe then we say, well, really, the Native American would be the closest, right?
And I relate to it more than I do most other, in a sense, because I think it's here.
Mm-hmm. So, before we leave this topic of, you know, images and kind of making offerings to other beings, I kind of hesitate a little bit to bring this up, but I don't know when we'll be on this topic again. And so I would still say this is not magic, but this is like a little going beyond the practical understanding. But it's a big question for me. What is relating to these beings? There's some feeling about it, and I feel more and more encouraged in these relationships, but like my mind, my rational mind is like, what's going on? What is this? How can I talk about this? And I just found this one, you know, Tibetan take on this that I thought was, I don't know if it's so clear, but this is Toku Origen Rinpoche, the father teacher of my teacher. Many people insist that Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Dharma protectors, so-called deities. I think deity is not quite the right word, but that's often how it gets translated in English. You know, archetypal beings, we might say. Let's say for us it's mostly Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, are just our mind. Many people insist they're just our mind, and because the mind is empty, there aren't really Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And I think by mind here, I think he means like the imputational imagined mind, because later he's going to get more into it. Like they're just our conceptual constructions, so therefore they don't really exist. And he says, but the mind is not just an empty void, it also has a lucid knowing quality. The empty aspect of mind is Dharmakaya. So this is when we turn the light around and we just rest in this spacious awareness. It's empty of any reference points, like it has no boundaries or anything in it. That's the Dharmakaya. The empty aspect of mind is Dharmakaya, the truth, reality body of Buddha. But this empty aspect is naturally luminous. This luminosity or clarity or like living awareness, I might say, is Sambhogakaya. which is one of the three Buddha bodies, or it's like the it literally means like the bliss body, but it's like so Sambhogakāya. So when we talk about these Buddhas that created pure lands, like Amitabha Buddha and so on, and even in Soto Zen we even say the everlasting Shakyamuni Buddha is like not just the physical form, but there's some kind of like some kind of body that the Buddha manifests that can't be seen usually, but that can be related to and maybe even seen by bodhisattvas in certain kinds of samadhi. So this is in Zen too. We have this kind of thing actually. Anyway, this luminosity is Sambhogakāya, and these two kayas means bodies. The Dharma body and the bliss body of Buddha are never apart. Just like the sun or moon is never apart from the sky. Skies, Dharmakāya, and the Sambhogakāya is the luminous moon or sun. Another way to put it is that Dharmakāya is self-existing or naturally abiding wisdom, and Sambhogakāya is its natural expression or manifestation. The Dharmakāya is like a clear crystal, while the Sambhogakāya is like the colored light that shines out from the crystal. So how does the crystal create this light? They're inseparable, and yet one's you can't see anything, it's totally clear. One's a manifestation of light. So basically this point, and then the question is, are we talking about the emptiness and lucidity of this person's mind, like the, because it's sometimes said, like you can reach both in Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. They talk about like shikantaza is like kind of like you enter the Dharmakāya, you become the Dharmakāya, and then you can the expression of that. Perceptions that arise out of that can be like the clarity aspect or Sambhogakāya. So this gets a little bit like hard to see, but is it like if one Buddha realizes the Dharmakāya, is that Dharmakāya separate from the Dharmakāya nature of our own mind? You can't really say that they're separate. We've talked about this before. Are there many Buddha natures, or is there just one Buddha nature? I think you can't say one or many. It's inconceivable in this ultimate realm. So therefore, like Shakyamuni Buddha realizing the Dharmakāya and then manifesting a form body, including the Sambhogakāya, is then like a body that's actually imminent in this world that we can relate to, and that when we're making offerings to Shakyamuni Buddha, whose physical body is long gone, his Nirmanakaya is long gone, his Dharmakaya never comes and goes, and his Sambhogakāya, you could say we're making offerings to that, and that's not nothing. It's not just a mental projection. Or if that sounds too dualistic, that it's still something out there, there's this way in which there's just one Dharmakāya. So it's this mind, and all minds have this Sambhogakāya aspect. That's what this teacher was pointing to, is like the clear luminosity of our own Buddha nature is like what we call Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they appear in these particular forms. And This is bordering on the magical. That's why I hesitate to bring it up. But it's a little different than saying, oh, there's some invisible beings that I don't know where they came from floating in the sky. this kind of story makes it seem like they're not actually out there. They're not external to mind. They're not separate from mind. And yet, they're a particular aspect of mind, like Sambhogakaya beings that we can relate to. And maybe like in dreams or after death or whatever, then we really relate to them up front, because in our usual waking consciousness is we're so accustomed to the clunky physical realm that like the Sambhogakayas don't appear. So we make offerings to a constructed image on the altar, but that image is connected to the Sambhogakayas like dwelling in there, and through our mind and all minds and the Buddha nature of all beings, it's some kind of hard to talk about happening here. So I don't know if that just sounds totally confusing and weird, but I wouldn't say I've really fully understand this either. But something struck me about that story, but we're relating to Sambhogakaya luminosity of Buddhas. Yes.
So is that the translation of the word Sambhoga is luminosity?
It's more like the literal translation is like bliss. Sambhoga is like,
yes, I've heard that bliss often,
yeah.
But for whatever reason, those words with those three qualities, I always just kind of, I can't grasp. I don't know. I just sort of blank out on those words.
But it goes together with clarity. This bliss.
Clarity.
Yeah. Bliss and clarity are like almost like different aspects of the same thing. Whereas emptiness, vast, spacious emptiness, is the other side.
It's the Dharma.
The Dharmakaya, where it's like beyond bliss, there's no, and it's beyond expression.
Yeah.
It's a vast emptiness, but that emptiness is expressed or manifested in its most maybe refined, pure form as Sambhogakaya, which is blissful, luminous clarity. And this, can sound like abstract, but I think actually we can have this experience of this in Zazen.
No, I think when you use that word,
yeah, yeah. Like when you, like it may be even, I don't want to equate these exactly, but say you turn the light around and you're just totally settled, you're letting go of everything, dropping off everything, but your senses are still open. So actually, you may be from this vast, spacious reservoir of boundlessness, you still hear the children at school screaming to each other, and that's like this, but it's coming out of this womb of light, and it's like maybe for a moment we hear those children's screams as Sambhogakaya, blissful. It's clear, it's a clear radiance, because it's not nothing. That's the point. It's not a void nothingness. And is it blissful? Is it the feeling of bliss? It might sometimes be like that, right? It's like, this what's kind of annoying before is now like this just display of energy. And since there's no resistance to it at all, it's all like joyful.
A little bit different with a riot versus children
playing. Maybe. Maybe for Buddha, maybe even a riot would be joyful, I don't know.
Well, yeah, forcing my mind.
And how does this relate to these, beings? It could be that, this is where you who knows if it's true or not, but some people say in these samadhi realms of like the union of empty spaciousness and clear luminosity expression, that people have visions of these bodhisattvas and Buddhas in the particular ways that, like, this is what they look like. So this is where we could be talking. I don't want to say if this is true or not, but this could be starting to get to be magical thinking. But that's why the images don't change. They do change a little bit over cultures, but they're like Avalokiteshvara sometimes manifests with one face, sometimes 11 faces, sometimes 2 arms, 4 arms, or 1,000 arms. But there aren't just, you can't just have random variations. Like, I think I'll make her with just 70 arms today. Like, she manifests in these particular forms. Yeah, so we could say this Sambhogakaya expression is not just random. It's an expression, it's a Buddha expression that comes forth in particular ways in order and only in order to benefit all beings. You usually don't, right? It's exactly, it's there for us. So sometimes, yeah. So somebody made this vow that, like, I want to, you know, in some realm, some mind realm, they made this vow, like, I want to benefit beings in so many ways. The way I want to do this is I want to sprout 1,000 arms with an eyeball on each hand so that it can see how to help this person and help them, while over here this one can help that one, and it can help exactly 1,000 beings at the same time.
Is that Buddhist multitasking?
Yeah. But actually not, though, right? Avalokiteshvara's singular task of saving all beings simultaneously as one task. With one mind. You know, and so these are like stories, but, you know, again, I appreciate those stories because it challenges my rational mind. It's like, this is like crazy. We just want to like help some people to like in their daily struggle. And this is like, sounds way beyond this, but I think it's the same spirit. It's coming from, we want to help in these practical ways, but like, let's arouse this vision of like the most exalted way we could do that. And there's an intention behind that of 1,000 arms.
But that happens when you give money like to charities that give money all, to all these
sort of like that.
Or food, same thing.
Yeah, way things work is like not so limited as we think. In the Zen tradition, things are simpler. So Huangbo, who is, we heard about Baijan, is the one who said, have a mind like wood and stone. His student was Huangbo. And Huangbo, one time was doing this ritual of 3 prostrations to an image on the altar. And in Zen, people start questioning stuff like that, right? Because it's so direct. There was a novice monk who would later become the emperor of China. This is a true story, right? True. This is, you know, a record from Chinese ancestors. This novice monk noticed Huangbo entering the hall and making 3 prostrations to the Buddha, whereupon he asked, well, if we're not seeking anything from Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, what are you seeking to do with these prostrations? And Huangbo said, I don't seek from Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha, and I show my respect in this way. It's like, it's my custom to pay respects in this way, but you could say, I don't seek Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and to express that, I bow. And the monk says, well, what purpose does it serve? And Huangbo slapped him, as they did commonly in those days. And the novice said, oh, how uncouth you are. And Huangbo said, what? You're making a distinction between refined and uncouth, and stop them again. We don't have too many stories about Zen stories about like ritual enactment, but that's one of them. It's kind of simple. Yes, so there's a footnote here by John Blofeld who says just that. He says, like, you readers should know that this was no small matter to slap the emperor. They knew he was he's just being a monk for a while before he took office. And he said, you know, in China, you immediately executed for that. So this shows that Huang Bo is, like, not afraid of anything. And this is another sort of Zen, sort of like simpler thing. I almost hesitated here because I thought this is too like simple, and I don't know if I agree with him, but I'll share it because maybe you can relate. This is Francis Cook commenting on this section of Hotsu Mujo Shin, where Dogen talks about these practices of giving a handful of sand and rice to Buddhas are, all of these things are arousing the Bodhi mind, right? All these little Buddhist practices. And Francis Cook says, why are all these activities the same as arousing the thought of enlightenment? As Dogen defines it, arousing the thought of enlightenment is truly a momentous affair. Yet here it's said to be the same as doing zazen, offering someone a morsel of food, offering a few flowers to the Buddha, and so on. Why this is so will be clearer if we remember how hard it is for us to do these things. It's hard for ordinary people to give rather than take. It's hard to perform what seem to be meaningless or unprofitable actions, such as bowing to the Buddha or offering him incense. Zazen itself is hard because we don't really believe we get anything from it. It's just lost time and not much fun. It's really a difficult thing to do, to offer a few flowers and bow to the Buddha. I said I hesitated because it doesn't seem that difficult, does it? I mean, I don't know what y'all think, but he's saying it's really difficult for us to do this.
Maybe the first time we did it.
The first time, maybe.
That is for some of us.
And maybe also in sesshin to do it over and over.
No, I go through every sesshin that's like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Just like, can I be making better use of my time today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do you like those long morning services? All Buddha's 10 directions, must be time to get up. No, let's do another chant. Okay, it's hard. What seem to be meaningless, unprofitable acts. It's really difficult. Obviously, the person who can easily do these things looks at life in a different way than most people do. Even to be able to do them at all, right? Nobody's like walked out yet. Actually, a few people have. Okay. So you people are really arousing some bodhicitta. A person who can easily, or maybe we say can even do it all, these things, looks at life in a different way than most people do. For now, one can do things without weighing them in terms of profit and loss. She has aroused the thought of enlightenment, which means she gives whatever she's capable of giving, however small and inexpensive, and he honors the Buddha and shows his gratitude in many ways. It's therefore true that to honor the Buddha with whatever poor thing one has and to give freely to others without any thought of benefit or loss is a sure sign that one has aroused the thought of enlightenment. I thought, whoa, that's going pretty far, Francis. Because this is what it means to arouse the thought of enlightenment. The act is performed in many ways, some of which I have discussed in other chapters. It is, for instance, faith, because both faith and arousing the thought of enlightenment are nothing more than an unshakable trust in the truth and value of the Buddha's teaching and a determination to live one's life in accord with that teaching. It's also identical with leaving home, for real leaving home, as I will mention later, is a complete renunciation of fame, fortune, power, and security, and a new orientation towards the Buddha and his teaching. In other words, arousing the thought of enlightenment, faith, and leaving home are all forms of what Dogen Zenji calls dropping off body and mind. We can go through all the proper motions doing Zen in a formalistic way, but this is not good enough. So he is saying it's not just doing these forms. What's that?
Empty ritual.
It's clear that Dogen had an extremely rigorous definition of what it means to follow the Dharma. It's no easy thing to really follow the way. But then he says, if you can just manage to like offer some chants and incense and bows to the Buddha, this is what's really difficult. With the wish to guide all others there before ourselves, which I just thought, well, what does Suzuki Roshi say about bodhicitta? And it's so nice because, you know, we have like every Dharma talk Suzuki Roshi ever gave and one 3,000 page file. And you can just search it for bodhicitta, which came up with no responses. And Bodai Shin also came up with none. But way-seeking mind, I think is Suzuki Roshi's translation of bodhicitta, way-seeking mind. Or in Japanese, Do-shin is way mind, the mind of the way, which is another classical of Dogen's. Suzuki Roshi says, if you don't have this way-seeking mind, which I think means bodhicitta, even though you attain enlightenment, that enlightenment is so-called dry enlightenment. There's no meaning in it. Which may mean, like, the compassionate aspect. And somebody asks, how would it be possible to truly help somebody else unless you have some enlightenment yourself? If the vow is to bring all beings to enlightenment before yourself, he says, yeah, this is a good question, I think. And this is, we had this discussion already, right, about the shepherd, the problem with the shepherd thing, which I felt like there was maybe some problem. I had this question. And then he has this long discussion with his students about it. And then Suzuki Roshi says, to help others and to help yourself is the same, not different. We feel better when we help others. To help others is to help yourself. And to help yourself without paying any attention to others is also to help others. How about that one? Don't you think so? He says. If you're observing your way carefully, that will help others. It's like taking care of your own practice. Before we attain perfect enlightenment, just to seek for enlightenment is a great help for others. So we might have this problem with seeking here, right? And he likes this term way-seeking mind, but we might say the effort to practice. Before we attain perfect enlightenment, just to seek for enlightenment, or just to practice in this direction, which is like the aspiration, like the vow. I wish to attain perfect enlightenment for all beings. that seeking, non-self-centered seeking, is a great help for others. Suzuki Roshi says. I also came across the point that that the goal in Mahayana Buddhism, sometimes we get cautious around these words, goals, but you know, if we use goal in like a not a self-centered way, but like the direction it's going, what's the point of it all anyway? In that sense, the goal is actually to save all beings, not to realize enlightenment. The goal is to free all beings from suffering, and the means is to realize enlightenment. I thought that's interesting. That's the shepherd, maybe, emphasis, right? The goal is not to realize enlightenment and be free from all suffering. That's why in our Bodhisattva vows, first we say, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Okay, so how should I go about that? Well, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it, and I vow to enter all the Dharma gates, and I vow to end all delusions. But that's all just like the means to the end of saving beings. It's a little dualistic. I mean, Dogen probably wouldn't talk that way, because he'd say it's the same. Saving all beings is realizing enlightenment.
That brings to mind Mother Teresa that went to India to serve the poor and ended up being sainthood or sainted, I guess, or whatever, because she just gave so much and so freely all her life.
Yeah.
She became that. Herself. I mean, that was not her intention.
Yeah.
Her intention was simply to serve the poor.
Yeah. And what a beautiful person. And as I think I mentioned, you know, we went to one of her mother houses in Kathmandu.
Yeah.
These Nepalese nuns have this daily practice of just serving, and it's so inspiring and so humbling. I'm like, this is their spiritual practice, and like, I couldn't even do it for one. I could do it for half a day. I'm like, I'm so glad to get out of here. I can't stand this, actually.
Wow.
So, you went? Did you go?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty intense.
It's pretty intense.
Yeah.
What do they do?
And I felt a little guilty about. I'm so relieved. This is too much to take.
Yeah, it's very physically.
What do they do?
Well, what we did was basically this. It's a hospice kind of setting, and it's very old people who are either dying or just very old, and a lot of them who can't control their bowels and can't walk and whatever. So it's in the pretty primitive condition of the way things are in India.
Yeah.
So basically, like I spend the morning just washing clothes,
and it's
with all by hand with cold water. And you're just kind of, and the first bucket it's got shit and piss and whatever, and you're washing that one, and then you go to another bucket, and then you're squeezing it all out, and you're putting it on the line. But it's just very, it's very physical, and it's, there's a lot of smells. And
sure.
Some of the people are yelling at you, I work with old people here too, so it's kind of like that same kind of work, but even more so because it's no electricity, it's cold water, and you're doing it all like with your very own hands. So
they're yelling at you in Nepali and assuming you should understand what they need. Sorry, I'm just here.
Yeah.
That feeling of kind of helpless too, But I was thinking about Mother Teresa, that these letters got published kind of recently. Did anybody see that? A few years ago. Her journal, I think, about her later years, where she was like writing about, she was like losing faith in God. She was really questioning her faith. But she kept doing the serving, but she's like, I don't know about any of this anymore. And people were shocked to find this journal, because they're like, she's the perfectly pure, totally, total faith, right?
Yeah.
And but she had all this doubt, secretly, that got brought out later. So I thought, but she's just doing it. So we might have doubt about, I don't know, should I prostrate to the Buddha this time? that all sounded like a nice story, but I have some doubts about it. So, like, but we still do it.
That's the key.
We just do it.
So, I mean, that's just right to the whole deal for me. It's just what you just said or are talking about. It's like seeing the impossible, the uselessness, the futility, you know. Not only of death and old age and all the that decay, but you know, maybe we're in the sixth extinction and everything's just going, you know, as it has five other times, you know, as far as you know, our scientists know, and they're pretty convinced this is, but that just in the face of futility and the possibility that there is no other thing after this life, and the possibility that you know we will destroy ourselves, and the possibility that we can't save anybody, and yet we just go on. You know, we just go on. Why? Because we think it's the right thing to do. You know,
that's the Bodhisattva way.
Well, that's you know Thomas Paine. You said, "My country is the world, and my religion is to do good." You know, I mean. And you know how much farther do you really have to go? I mean, I like Thomas Paine, obviously, you know, but you know, the guy knew. Anyway,
yeah.
This willingness, you know, just right through the darkness, you know, but not with a hope of saving anything. Mm-hmm. But you just
carry on.
Well, it's what's right,
mm-hmm.
And you just feel like, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and with the support of each other. Crazy room of bodhisattvas who didn't walk out yet. We together, it's maybe crazy, but
here we are.
Here we are. We're going to do it to the bitter end. Till the whole universe is destroyed in a raging firestorm. We will keep sitting. And constructing stupas and offering flowers to Buddhas.
What else is there to do?
What else is there to do?
What do you have with the other sleeve if you have a stupid?
I have to wait for this afternoon to see them. The left hand sleeve. There's you know, don't even ask, but the other realms of expressions are up the sleeve. We dedicate the merit generated, whether or not there is any. To all beings everywhere, may they receive it with joy. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.